Next is the final chapter in the unit. This one has to do with gene expression, which includes, but isn't, is more than, the what it, one part of what it includes, gene expression that is the other job of DNA. We just got done looking at one job of DNA in the previous chapter, that's DNA replication. What is the other main job of DNA? Transcription, correct. And so transcription is part of, but not all of, gene expression. It's the only part of gene expression that DNA is directly involved in, though. Gene expression refers to everything that happens when a gene gets expressed. That means it gets turned on, it gets activated, it gets read as a code. And transcription, which is part of gene expression, uses that code to produce a molecule. And then translation uses that molecule, DNA's job is done at that point, to serve as a code for how to build a protein. So gene expression results eventually in a protein being made from the information that was originally in the gene. That's what we mean when we say a gene is expressed. Now, keep in mind that every one of your cells has all of the genes. Every cell has the complete library, which you can think of as manuals for how to build molecules. Every cell has those, but no cell is going to want to use every manual. Right, your liver cells are never going to have to turn on the genes for being a spleen cell. Right? They're not going to need those. So, yes, the library is there, but a big fraction of the genes in any given cell within a multicellular organism are permanently turned off for the lifetime of that individual. Then there's the genes that are used by whatever type of cell that is, not all of those are ever turned on at once. You only express genes when you actually need the final product, and you turn them off when they're not needed. Okay, so gene expression is what we're looking at here, and that includes transcription and translation, as we'll talk more about in a minute. But the opening slide is a summary of an important biological experiment that happened after we knew from those other experiments we talked about, that DNA is the genetic material, where the big question was, now that we know that, how does DNA work? So that's where we are in the history of things. And this experiment was designed to test a hypothesis that was proposed that's called, or was called, the one gene, one enzyme hypothesis. Which is a shorthand way of saying that they hypothesized that maybe the way DNA works is that a gene, which is DNA, corresponds to a specific enzyme. Which is kind of a reasonable prediction or assumption because there are so many enzymes in an organism, right? Since they're specific, you have to have a hell of a lot of different enzymes because you have a hell of a lot of different kind of chemical reactions occurring. And I'm not going to get into really the particulars of how this setup works because it's not actually the main point. But what they did was intentionally mutate the DNA by exposing mold cells to ultraviolet radiation. So they randomly caused mutations. And they saw what effect that had on a biochemical pathway. Because remember that a biochemical pathway is multiple individual end-to-end reactions. Each reaction requires an enzyme. So they were basically testing their one gene, one enzyme hypothesis by saying if we destroy a gene, that should make it impossible for a pathway to get past a certain point because that enzyme no longer can operate. Okay, that's the basics of it. one gene, one enzyme hypothesis ends up being not true. Kind of close, but not true. And one reason, I mean, the main reason for that is that, yes, there are a lot of genes that code for enzymes, but not every gene codes for an enzyme. Because not all proteins are enzymes, right? There's all kinds of other proteins that aren't enzymes that the cell has to know how to build, and that's what genes are for. Well, they revised it into the so-called one gene, one protein hypothesis, which is closer to the truth, but that's still wrong, actually. And that's because not all genes necessarily have anything to do with building a protein. The majority do, the vast majority. And we call those genes protein-coding genes. Those are the ones we're going to study in this chapter, because we're talking about gene expression to build a protein. Well, that takes a protein-coding gene. And so just a minute ago I told you that that involves transcription and translation. Transcription is the only part of the process that DNA is involved in. But if you have a protein-coding gene, what is the direct product? We haven't really talked about the details yet in this chapter, but long ago I told you what the product is. Do you remember what the direct product is of transcription? If you start with a protein-coding gene, what gets produced in transcription? Not a protein. That's the ultimate goal. But it's an indirect process. DNA doesn't directly code for a protein. Directly codes for what comes out of transcription. Do you remember what that is? It's not protein, it is an RNA molecule, specifically messenger RNA or mRNA. DNA's job is done at that point when transcription produces the mRNA. But now mRNA is carrying the code. And it can go on to the second major process, translation, which uses the code in the mRNA to build an actual polypeptide. That's why it's an indirect process between DNA and protein. All right, that happens for the vast majority of genes. But there are other genes, which is why the one gene, one protein hypothesis is still wrong. There are other genes besides protein-coding genes, and we call them non-protein coding genes, that code for something other than mRNA. They also get transcribed, but it's not transcription for the purpose of producing mRNA. For non-protein coding genes, transcription creates other kinds of RNA. mRNA is just one of many kinds of RNA. And we'll talk about some of those many kinds in this chapter. But the point is, a cell doesn't know how to make any RNA, just like it doesn't know how to make any protein. It has to be told how to, right? So the protein-coding genes are the genes that code for how to build messenger RNA, which then goes on to translation to build proteins. The non-protein-coding genes are there to be codes for how to build other kinds of RNA just for their own right. They are the goal. They don't go on to translation. They're just RNA molecules. Okay? So that's why it's wrong to say one gene, one protein, because there are non-protein coding genes as well. They eventually stopped revising the name of this. I'm just telling you why they're wrong. Even though if you include only the protein coding genes and ignore the non-protein coding genes, it's still wrong to say one gene, one protein, because as we'll see and as I'll explain, eukaryotic cells can have a single gene, single protein coding gene that in different circumstances can code for multiple different kinds of proteins. So it's not one protein coding gene, one protein, even. But We're going to study the usual case, which is a protein coding gene, not a non-protein coding gene, undergoing the steps of gene expression to yield eventually a polypeptide. Oh, I'm sorry, I skipped one of the steps of the wrongness. A little closer to the truth be after one gene, one protein is one gene, one polypeptide, which is closer still to the truth, but there's a reason why that's also not true. If you think about multimeric proteins, we talked about multimeric proteins, right? They're the ones that have quaternary structure, which means they're made out of at least two polypeptides. In some of those, the two or more polypeptides are different. Like in hemoglobin, there's four overall polypeptides, but there's two kinds of polypeptides. And therefore, that requires two different genes for that one overall protein. So it is more correct to say one gene, one polypeptide than it is to say one gene, one protein. But it's still wrong for those other reasons I told you about non-protein coding genes and the fact that one gene can actually, under different circumstances, code for multiple polypeptides. Okay, now to two. Once again, we have a comparison of prokaryotic cell on the top to a eukaryotic cell on the bottom, but now we're comparing them on the basis of how gene expression happens. Notice that in both, though, transcription and translation are happening. Those together make up gene expression, and transcription always has to happen first and then translation. Transcription, as I've said, is the only part of gene expression that DNA is directly involved in. And that's why it happens first, because DNA is the original code. In any kind of cell, prokaryotic or eukaryotic, transcription has to happen where the DNA is, of course, since DNA is involved. Well, in a prokaryotic cell, the DNA is just part of the cytoplasm because there is only one compartment in a prokaryotic cell. So that's where transcription happens, in the cytoplasm in a prokaryote. In a eukaryotic cell, on the other hand, there is a dedicated membrane-bounded organelle housing the DNA, the nucleus. And so transcription is happening where the DNA is, which is in the nucleus of a eukaryotic cell. Translation, on the other hand, has to happen in the cytoplasm. Well, in a prokaryotic cell, that's the only chamber, so no problem. But in a eukaryotic cell, it's slightly more complex because the product of transcription, which we call the messenger RNA transcript, this red piece of RNA, that's produced in the nucleus in a eukaryotic cell, but it needs to get out into the cytoplasm to be used for translation. That's a problem that the prokaryotic cell doesn't have. So there's that complication. But also, the mRNA that's produced by transcription in a prokaryotic cell is ready to go right off of the assembly line. Ready to go meaning it's ready to go right into translation. On the other hand, not only does the RNA have to get out of the nucleus in a eukaryotic, so it's in that sense not ready, but it's also not chemically ready. What comes directly off the transcription assembly line in a eukaryotic cell is called pre-mRNA because it has to be modified after transcription in order to be able to get out of the cell, out of the nucleus, I mean. You see these yellow ends that have been added later? So the pre-mRNA is not ready to go. It needs to be converted into the mature mRNA, which then has to leave the nucleus and do the translation job. The translation job in either kind of cell involves the mRNA meeting up with a ribosome, which remember is a non-membrane bounded organelle, a tiny molecular machine really, that is able to read the sequence of nucleotides in the mRNA and use that sequence as a code telling the ribosome how to build the polypeptide. Two major aspects to that. The code needs to tell the ribosome how many amino acids to use, so how long it's going to be, And also, which specific kind of amino acid needs to be in each position. In other words, the sequence. The polypeptide is the purple string of beads in this picture. Each bead is an amino acid. All right, now to three. The top box shows just a little bit of a chromosome, or the DNA from a chromosome, I should say. It's a tiny bit because, as I said, a chromosome, the DNA in a chromosome is millions of nucleotides long, and hundreds to thousands of genes are contained in just one chromosome. Only three are shown here just for simplicity, but there's many more in a typical overall DNA. Also, what is shown here is that each gene is separated from the rest by a sequence of DNA between them. Now, the overall length of the DNA for the whole chromosome is just an enormously long sequence of A's, T's, C's, and G's. That's all it is, nucleotide sequence. Genes are no different. Each gene is itself a nucleotide sequence. It's just a subset of the overall sequence. All right? In other words, there's nothing structurally different about a gene compared to these sequences between genes. But the cell, because of the specific sequence, recognizes genes, the beginning and the ending of genes, because of the particular nucleotides that are in that place. It's not physically different, though. What's not really shown here well, or it's exaggerated, is that the sequences of DNA between the genes is really much longer than what's shown here. The spacing between genes, in other words. Because when you consider the overall amount of DNA in terms of number of nucleotides, if you add up all of the nucleotides that make up all the genes in your genome, the total amount of your DNA, those make up only about 2% of your overall DNA. So the overwhelming majority of your DNA doesn't code for making any proteins, or for any kind of RNA, I mean. It's just sometimes called junk DNA. It's not total junk. We're learning what it does, but it does stuff we're not going to get into in this course. Anyway, it's all sequences that aren't coding for any RNAs. And that's most of your DNA. So the genes are really spaced more than they're shown here. Well, we're looking at, though, just one little piece of just one of these genes. This inset here is the double-stranded DNA that we're looking at. So, in the previous function, in the last chapter, DNA replication, both of the strands were important, right? Each individual strand was being used in the process of DNA replication as a template for how to build a copy of the other one. That's not what we're doing here. Here we're doing transcription. So first of all, not the entire length of the DNA is used. It's just a gene. So it's just going to be opened up locally at that gene, not the whole thing. But also, each gene really uses only one of the two strands. The code that is really the business part of the gene is the sequence on just one of the two strands. Could be either one. This is the top one that's shown here that's labeled as the template strand. But the template strand is the strand in a gene that gets read in the process. The sequence gets read. The other one is basically not used. You have to separate the two strands for DNA replication and for transcription. So we're going to separate the two strands. But when we separate the two strands, one of them will be used and the other one will just be out of the way temporarily until transcription is done, and then they'll just go right back together because they're complementary to each other. Which is important, by the way, because that protects the two strands. There's pretty good evidence that life started out RNA-based, because RNA also has codes. But RNA is single-stranded, and therefore it's a lot easier to get damaged. So eventually DNA overtook RNA in early biological history, because being double-stranded, the hydrogen bonding protects each strand from damage. Well, anyway, this is the template strand. This one is just there to be removed during the transcription to get it out of the way. And you can see that the template strand of the DNA is going to be directly used in transcription to create an mRNA transcript. And then the mRNA transcript is going to be used as a code for translation to actually assemble a polypeptide. Let me go over these two words, why they were chosen, because they both start in trans, and a lot of students confuse them and can't remember which is which. Once again, as so often I try to stress, it's important to think about the meanings of words in everyday life. So a transcription refers to making a transcript. Transcription just means rewriting, right? A transcript is a written account of something that someone said, for instance. But it's not a change in language. It's just a rewriting. That was chosen here because in this process, we're staying within the same language, the language of nucleotides. Nucleotides are like the words of the language. Now, yes, we're going from DNA to RNA, but that's kind of like two dialects of the same language. So it's not really changing language. We start out with nucleotides, we're going to end up with nucleotides. We're just rewriting the code in the form of messenger RNA, where it started out in the form of DNA. Translation, on the other hand, is a word that means a change in language, right? And that makes good sense because in this part, you're using the language of nucleotides in the RNA and translating that into the language of amino acids. The words now are amino acids, not nucleotides. So that's a totally different language. So think of it that way, and that will help you remember which is which. Transcription has to happen first, though, because you need that intermediate code, the messenger RNA, in order to tell the ribosome how translation needs to proceed. And now to the process of comparing the process of transcription to translation in terms of codes. Transcription is pretty straightforward because it's a one-to-one correspondence on a per-nucleotide basis. What I mean by one-to-one is that a single nucleotide that's being read in the gene, in the DNA, corresponds to a single nucleotide in the messenger RNA. All you have to do is use strict complementarity rules, right? Except that you're building RNA, not DNA, so you have to remember something about RNA. Not only does it use ribose instead of deoxyribose, but also it doesn't use the same four nitrogenous bases as DNA does, right? RNA uses uracil instead of thymine. And that's why if you read an A in the DNA, which would normally call for a T by complementarity rules, you instead have to use a U. But everywhere you see a C, you just put a G. So it's a one-to-one correspondence. You simply have to read one nucleotide at a time. Each nucleotide in DNA corresponds to one nucleotide in RNA. It would be really nice if you could also do that in translation. In other words, if there could also be a one-to-one correspondence in translation. One-to-one correspondence between RNA and amino acids. There cannot be, though. Who can tell me why that's impossible? In other words, why is it not possible for a single RNA nucleotide to stand for a specific amino acid, and then another kind of RNA nucleotide specifies as a different amino acid, and so on? Why is that not possible? Why can't you have one RNA nucleotide like this U say? Why can't you say, okay, U is always going to stand for tryptophan, which is what this amino acid is. And G will say it means phenylalanine, and so on. Why can't you do that? Yes. Well, it's a good guess, but it's not right. How many nucleotide choices do you have in RNA? How many kind of nucleotides are there? Not how long is it, not how many nucleotides, how many different kinds of nucleotides are there in RNA? Four. Adenine, uracil, guanine, and cytosine. How many biological amino acids are there? 20. There's 20. That's the answer. 4 does not equal 20, right? 4 is fewer than 20. So you would, if you did that one-to-one, you would run out as soon as you specified 4 amino acids, right? There are still 16 more amino acids that you need to be able to specify. So there can't be a one-to-one correspondence since you don't have 20 different kinds of RNA nucleotides. If you did, then it would have evolved that way because the simplest things are the things that evolve, things that natural selection chooses. Well, the next simplest thing, therefore, would be to use two nucleotides, a sequence of two nucleotides, as a code for specifying an amino acid. So if you have, which you do, 4 kinds of nucleotides, how many different 2-digit sequences are there possible? No, there's 4 just for a 1-digit, because there's 4 different kinds of nucleotides. If you have a 2-digit sequence, 2-letter in this case, for how many possibilities? Let's just do it with numbers. It's like saying how many 2-digit numbers are there when you have 4 numerals to work with, 1, 2, 3, and 4. Right? You can have 1-1, 1-2, 1-3, 1-4, 2-1, 2-2, and so on, right? 16. 4 times 4, or 4 to the second power, if you're using a 2-digit. Well, that didn't evolve because 16 is still not enough, right? You have to have 20 different codes at least. So what did evolve was the simplest possibility, which is 3. How many possible 3-digit or 3-letter combinations are there?
20.
No?
9.
No. How did you get 16 for 2?
You squared.
Right. So what is it for 3?
3 squared.
4 cubed. 4 raised to the third power. 4 times 4 times 4? 64. 64, right. 4 times 4 times 4, which is 16 times 4, right? Well, that's plenty. All you need are 20. 64 does the job. And therefore, that's the simplest possibility. That's what natural selection made happen. And that's why, however many individual nucleotides there are in a messenger RNA transcript in red here, it's functionally divided into triplets or sequences of 3 nucleotides, each of which is called a codon. Because a single codon, which is 3 nucleotides, specifies uniquely a specific amino acid. And strictly speaking, the word codon really refers to triplets in the RNA, the messenger RNA. But a lot of times, just for convenience, people also use the word codon to refer to a triplet in the DNA that specified the codon in RNA. It's really, though, correct to talk about codons being the RNA, not the DNA. There is a correspondence, of course, though, right? ACC in the DNA specified the codon UGG. You see what I'm saying there? By complementarity rules. Okay, so that's why each individual amino acid corresponds in translation to a triplet, a codon in the messenger RNA, because you have to have 20, at least 20 different combinations. Well, there are 64, which is plenty. And if there's no limit to the number of amino acids, but organisms, you can make as many as you want in a lab, but organisms use the same set of 20 amino acids, so this works well. And that brings us to 4, which I think is probably a good place to stop, right on time. I was going to stop there anyway, but I am out of time.